Blog Talk Radio.
And a very happy holidays to all you Metsian folk out there. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Metsian Podcast. This is also the last night of Hanukkah, so a big shout-out to my Jewish brethren. Happy Hanukkah to all of you. And without further ado, let's get right into the hot stove chatter. Let's bring on our guest. He was the QB, the Queens Baseball Convention. I'm like reading the Twitter handle. The Queens Baseball Convention host. He's an actor. He's a comedian. He's a voiceover artist, and that's John Stapanaro. What's going on, man?
Hey, what's going on, man? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I love talking Mets, especially in the off season. I think everybody likes to play GM, put their GM caps on, and any extra time I can get to talk about our New York Mets is always welcome. So I appreciate it.
Well, what I like about this hot stove, how is this hot stove different than all other hot stoves? Is that we get to put on our president of baseball operations cap. For the first time in Mets history, David Stearns is the president of baseball operations. And before we get into the weeds about what's going on, because I'm very curious, I'm not exactly certain what your angle is, but I was getting into it a little bit with Mets fans yesterday on both sides of the fence who kind of are not freaking out like some people are, and then those who are not exactly freaking out, but criticizing, if you will. So I'm very curious to hear your angle. But before we do, we did have Mark Healy on our last podcast, who was also part of the Queens Baseball Convention. So I think this is a perfect bookend place to start with this podcast and talk about, since I wasn't able to be there, how was the Queens Baseball Convention this year, coming from the host himself?
The Queens Baseball Convention is great. I think it's great every year. I'm not just saying that because I've been involved with it, but rather that I've been fortunate to be involved with it. Keith and Dan, who are, kind of the brains behind the operation over the last decade, tasked me with hosting the overall event and, also doing some of the interview panels as well over the last three years of the QBC. And it's so much fun. It's a great way to connect with the Mets community. Like, I've met people that I've interacted with either from my Mets podcast or people that I've just interacted with on Mets Twitter. Like, I've met them in person as a result of the QBC. And, when I tell people, you mentioned that I'm in entertainment and I do a lot of stuff. And, when I tell people, oh, I'm hosting the Queens Baseball Convention, and if they're not Mets fans or they're not from New York, they're like, what is that? And the best way for me to explain it to them is that it's basically the de facto Mets fan fest. The Mets themselves as a team, as a franchise, as an entity, don't do a fan fest. And the Queens Baseball Convention fills that void, and I would say fills it in a great way. I think if the Mets did a fan fest, you'd want it to be what the Queens Baseball Convention is. So, there's a great – they get great guests every year that have to do with the Mets, either current or former Mets players, coaches, things like that. There's a lot of great people involved from SNY. I think they've been a sponsor of the QBC since like year two or three. They bring people over from Baseball Night in New York, and they bring people over from their official, the Mets Pod, their podcast. They bring people over, to just represent and really kind of go over the state of affairs with the New York Mets. And so, it's a really great thing that I'm happy we were able to get back to after COVID because, it really is done with it's a labor of love. It's a blood, sweat, and tears operation for Dan, for Keith, and for everybody that works with them and volunteers their time to make it happen. And when you have something like that, the fear is when you shake the snow globe the way that, the COVID pandemic did, that maybe that wouldn't come back, right? You know, people would kind of move on in their lives or, you know, not have the resources to do it or even the wherewithal. And so the fact that after a brief hiatus, it came back at the end of last year. And then, you know, this year it's kind of found its home once again. You know, it's going to be rolling every year for the foreseeable future. And, you know, I will gladly be a part of it for as many years as they would have me, because it's so much fun.
Yeah, and I want to give a shout out to both Keith Blacknick and I don't want to pronounce it incorrectly. Dan Koh, how do you pronounce his last name again?
It's actually a little bit more phonetic than you would think. It's Tuig.
There you go. There you go. Excuse me, Dan Tuig. So that's a fantastic job that they do. And I also, and I think this is kind of goes into the theme of what we're talking about, kind of the heat that Cohen's getting right now. That the reason why this thing started was because the Mets under the Wilpon regime didn't do a fan fest. And what's ridiculous about it is that, like, their last year they decided to do it, which is such a Wilponian thing to do, to be like, nah, you know what, now we're going to do one, after the success of the Queens Baseball Convention. And I think at this point, Steve kind of recognizes that it's kind of filling the void, that I think at this point it's kind of like, well, why would we need to do it? Maybe eventually, you know, I'd love to have Keith on here and Dan to talk about his communication with the team now that Steve has taken over. It's such a wonderful event, and I wish I could have made it this year. But that's great that that, you know, you're still involved and still going strong with it. And you know, it goes to show you. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I made a Mets fan documentary. Was because I think it's a very unique fan base and arguably the most unique because of the way the Mets were born out of two teams leaving a city that, you know, say what you want. Obviously, you're from Brooklyn, so it's kind of technically two cities if you want to go all the way back, because Brooklyn is really could have been its own city one way or another. But basically, it left two cities. There's no team, but I don't think any city has that in their history, two teams leaving. Usually it's one team being replaced. So I think that the Mets fan is a very unique breed, the new breed, as they were called originally. And that's why I called my documentary, shameless plug up front, The Newest Breed, A History and Guide to the Mets Fan. So it's great that it's still going strong, and I'll have to make it next year. And everybody, you can donate every single month if you would like, and I do so myself. I think I give like $10 to the Queens Baseball Convention every month via whatever they have set up, definitely like on PayPal on my end. So please go to queensbaseballconvention.com, go to their Twitter handle. Jesus, I'm all over my words tonight. Go to their Twitter handle or X, whatever you want to call it, X, Twitter, I don't care. Just go to QB Convention, at QB Convention, and you can donate to the cause of the Mets Fan Fest done by the fans. So thanks again, John, for giving us the rundown on that. And like I said, so let's get right into it. So the way I see it, everybody's like, I don't think everybody has enough nuance when it comes to these first 3 years coming up on four of Steve Cohen. And especially if you want to go very micro with the fact that David Stern has just taken over, they're really looking at it in a very dense way, if you will, some of them, you know, and I'm not trying to call them dense. I just think that it's buying into the reactionary nature of our modern times when it comes to analyzing, or not fully analyzing, lack thereof, what is going on within the machinations of this team right now. I think it was clear, based off of all the different types of contracts that he was giving out, that Steve was using his money for quick fixes. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Obviously, from, you know, the 2022 perspective, it fell completely flat by the end of the year.
And he had been, you know, obviously he had some misses with the GM, especially like when it comes to some off-field issues. But now he finally got his guy, a Mets fan himself in David Stearns, who grew up in the upper deck of Shea Stadium. And it's been a month and a half, and everybody's acting like he's basically been here 3 years. I think that when you see the way that Steve has gotten his feet wet, everybody basically thinks that he's going to know immediately, the second that he takes over ownership of a baseball team, that he's going to know how to operate a team. And I think it's clear that he's been feeling it out. And now he finally got his guy. He was patient with that. And he even said, I don't want to spend like a drunken sailor, but let's be, you know, like call a spade, last year he kind of did spend like a drunken sailor to the point that he took full advantage of this luxury tax thing that was basically called the Steve Cohen tax. And, you know, we'll get into the way the Dodgers are circumventing that, because I definitely want to talk about the Shohei Ohtani deal. But what is your opinion about all the different moves that David Stearns made, and from a macro perspective, everything that I just touched on regarding Steve Cohen's tenure so far? Because I'll leave it with this. I think people don't understand the way you can't shake something off overnight. It's not like you can get rid of the Wilpon stank right away and the stank of 60 years of underachieving. And I also think that all indications from the way he's running the organization and people I've talked to is that it's a complete 180 from a corporate level as well, from the job that the Wilpons were doing with the place. And I have other stuff to touch on when contrasting it with Yankees and the way how Steinbrenner is running it. But that I'll get into the weeds later. Please, go ahead. Your opinion of not only David Stearns, but the macro, now that we're in the fourth offseason of Steve Cohen's tenure.
Yeah, okay, so I have a lot of thoughts on this. I'll save David Stearns for later on. I think it's a fair to give him his own time, which pun not intended there, but give him his own time on this podcast as far as the conversation goes. From a Steve Cohen overview, I think you nailed it when you said that a lot of people's thoughts on this are very short-sighted. You know, there's the expression of common sense not being that common, and I would add to it that critical thinking is becoming less and less common as well. And, you know, us as Met fans, we are a rare breed. I think that New York sports fans are intelligent in general, and I think that when you're a fan of a team who doesn't necessarily win all the time or doesn't have a history of winning all the time, that does breed a different kind of intellectual fandom, because you have less fair weather fans, you have less bandwagon fans. No one can ever accuse the Mets, as currently constituted as a franchise, of having bandwagon fans. We haven't won a World Series in 37 years. So with all of that being said, I think that Steve Cohen himself, he's a winner in life. That's what he does. You don't become a billionaire without, you know, and a billionaire 17 times over or 14 times over without understanding what it takes to win and also having the luck that it takes to win. I think all of that is kind of wrapped up in a ball, right? Mark Cuban once said, if any billionaire tells you that they could do it again, they're lying to your face, because it takes a tremendous amount of luck. So whether you want to put, you know, how much of the stake you want to put on Steve Cohen, you know, getting the success and the reputation that he has on skill and ability and versus luck and timing and all those other things, they all have to work out. And I would say that they all have to work out similarly for you to build a championship team and a continually championship organization. So I'll say that. The next part of it is how quickly we forget. And not you and I, clearly, but some other people, how quickly we forget where things were with the Wilpons, especially at the end, in a post-Bernie Madoff, needing to take out loans to pay payroll era. The infrastructure that Steve Cohen is trying to build started from not zero, less than zero. They did not invest in player personnel. That's obvious. That you can fix by throwing money at a problem if you have a good free agent class. But they also did not invest in, you know, you mentioned smaller things, like they wouldn't do a fan fest because it cost too much money for them to do and they didn't see the point. They didn't want to invest in certain things that Steve Cohen is now investing in terms of upgrading what is already a great ballpark. They never really, as real estate people, chose to invest in developing the area in Willets Point around the ballpark. I don't understand. You want to talk about, you know, stroke of genius from billionaire business people. I don't understand why that's something the Wilpons never thought to undertake. Now, granted, they do own a lot of that land, and so Steve Cohen is going to have to be in bed with them if that is to come to fruition. But the Wilpons never really seemed to have it all together. The Mets had one of the smallest, if almost non-existent, analytical departments. The Mets didn't have a state-of-the-art pitching lab the way some of these other teams had now in the last 5 and 10 years become accustomed to building and growing and cultivating, like Tampa Bay, like Houston, you know, these teams that are perennially successful, especially with either finding or developing or finding diamonds in the rough, redeveloping pitchers. So when you look at everything that Steve Cohen had to do when he bought that team, and I think the other thing that people need to realize is that he was a minority owner when the Wilpons were here, and he also grew up a Mets fan. So he saw firsthand from a fan's perspective and from a very small slice an ownership perspective of what needed to be done. And I think the gift and the curse thus far in Steve Cohen's ownership of the Mets is Steve Cohen's money. Now, for all of us who came from the Wilpons especially and had to watch the Yankees under George Steinbrenner operate for years like they could just buy and sell whatever they wanted to succeed, and then more recent history watched the Dodgers do it, I think Mets fans were like, yeah, this is great. This is the best thing in the world. It's finally our turn to have an owner who's mega rich, who's not going to let money get in the way we watched constantly the Wilpons have money get in the way. But when you come in with that reputation, I don't think Steve Cohen, in year one of his ownership, could have said, hey, so we're going to trade Jacob deGrom. We are not going to go after any big-time players because the infrastructure here is terrible, and we have to build from the ground up. Our minor league system is not up to snuff. I can't get my hands on some of the executives I'd like to get, and so we're going to do a slow process and try to build. Because had he done that, it would have been a PR nightmare. It would have been, here's the man with $17 billion who just bought the Mets straight cash with no other investors, and now he's operating the same way the Wilpons are. We can't be patient. We're being asked to be patient, and for what? Because we have no stock. We have no equity in this new owner. And so what he did was the only thing he really knows how to do, which is, well, I'll spend the money. I will go out. I'm going to give the blessing to acquire Francisco Lindor, and then I'm going to sign him to a mega deal. Now, I love Lindor. I think he was a good get. I think he's been a great Met outside of a slow start his first season. But looking back, going and doing that deal at the time probably wasn't the right thing to do. Not trading Jacob deGrom was probably not the right thing to do. Then you fast forward, because the way that all of these issues were compounded was that he actually put together a very good team, a team that won 101 games, despite the fact that he had basically three general managers in 2 years, one of them in Sandy Alderson that was probably forced on him by the MLB. And so he was constantly dealing with moving parts, change in direction, no continuity, no consistency. And yet the Mets were last year, or I guess 2 seasons ago now, one of the best teams in baseball. Now, did they fall flat? Yeah, they fell flat. They lost in the wild card round. They allowed Atlanta to catch them. It is what it is. That's baseball, Susan. But when you look at everything that he did from the moment he took over, he had no choice then, because of the moves that he made in year one,
to double down on them heading into what was last season. Because then when you have Jacob deGrom walk in free agency, if you're the Met fans, the same ones that we know cannot be rational all the time, if he lets Jacob deGrom chooses to leave, which is what happened, and the Mets turned around and they said, well, we know that one of the greatest pitchers of a generation and one of the greatest pitchers in our franchise is leaving. We're going to replace him by signing Nate Eovaldi and Seth Lugo. People would have rioted in the streets. They would have said, we won 101 games last year. Jacob deGrom left. Justin Verlander was right there. Justin Verlander had, in some metrics, the best year of his career in terms of ERA and WHIP, wins the Cy Young. How could you not go out and get Verlander? How could you let money stand in the way? We're knocking on the door of a championship. So he had no choice but to make those moves. Now, unfortunately, the whole thing comes apart, and now we're left with this season, this coming season, that I think is going to be a reset, a recalibration year. Now, I've said the whole time I think the Mets are going to be competitive because I think that, one, they kind of have no choice but to be competitive because part of the Yankee and the Dodger model that they seem to be following is that you supplement your growth, your internal growth through the minors and through the farm system by acquiring free agents, taking on contracts that other teams refuse to take on to make your major league product as good as it possibly can be. So I think they will be competitive. The other part of it is David Stearns, we'll talk more about him in a little bit, but when he stripped down the roster to the studs, which is what he did, taking the 40-man roster from 40 to, I think, 28 or 27, you're going to have a lot of holes to fill. And now you're not going to fill all of them with superstars, but you can come as close to reshaping an entire team in your own image as you possibly could in one offseason. But a lot of this was born out of the fact that Steve Cohen took over. He took over a team that was in absolute dire straits. And he did the one thing he thought he needed to do based on PR and based on everything he's ever done in his life to succeed, and that is spend the money. And honestly, two seasons ago when they won 101 games, it was a great experience. It was a great ride, and I'm happy he did it. And if we have to take a little bit of a step back now as a result, I'm okay with being patient if there is a plan. I don't like when teams and organizations say, oh, you got to be patient, you got to be patient, and you're just on the hamster wheel. The Mets have broken the hamster wheel. They have now put an executive in place who you said grew up a Mets fan. He's the guy everybody would have wanted. He's also got a proven track record of success in a lot of areas, most notably building the bullpen and filling out a roster by doing the exact kind of moves we're watching him do in real time. So when people laugh at it and they say, oh, it's embarrassing we signed Trace Thompson, because I see a shrewd move to bring in what could be a fourth outfielder, and he's on a minor league deal. I live by the adage that there's no such thing as a bad one-year deal. Well, then you could amplify that by a million times and say there's no such thing as a bad minor league deal. So when I look at stuff like this, I don't see the issue. Now, I understand the impatience from a singular offseason perspective because it is – you can't help but get antsy. You see the Yankees get Juan Soto. You see the Dodgers get Shohei Ohtani. And you know as the other big dog financially, you want to see the thing happen. And, you know, so you want to see Yamamoto sign with the Mets. Unfortunately, he's probably the most highly touted player in free agency in the last however many years, and that includes Ohtani, because Ohtani clearly had preferences and a financial ceiling that other teams weren't going to go to. So when you look at this, it's not a slam dunk that he's going to come to the Mets. So I understand the impatience and the antsiness on a micro level over the last couple weeks and just this offseason, but to use your words, on a macro level, I think fans are being absurd. You have to let this thing happen. Forget about marinate. You just have to let it happen because right. Stearns has been in the job for 2 months, and Cohen has been in the job. You almost have to wash out the first year completely and say that it doesn't even count.
Right.
So he's only owned the team for basically, what do you want to say, 3 years? That's not enough time to overhaul the infrastructure. Look how long it took the Dodgers to become the Dodgers we know now when this group first purchased it from, you know, from McCourt, who was forced to sell. So, you know, this stuff doesn't happen overnight. I mean, I know it's cliche. People don't want to hear cliches, but Rome wasn't built in a day. You have to let it happen. You have to.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many different things to touch upon about what you said, and let's just start with the people forget so quickly, and like how easily they want to run with this. And you know, I think a part of it has to do with WFAN too, like basically in some fashion being the reactionary pulse of the people, because I remember when they were like, oh, is this Wilpon 2.0? It's like how quickly they forget. And mind you, that's a flashy headline to click on. But anybody who's comparing
they don't forget.
Steve.
right, exactly.
They know what they're doing.
I want to touch upon something interesting later on just about WFAN and a video that you put out earlier. But lest we forget how we laughed when R.A. Dickey was signed. like, you know, lest we forget that, like, if you look at the last few World Series winners, outside of the Red Sox, which is tarnished in 2018, as well as the Dodgers, which is tarnished because of COVID, it's been the Braves, the Nationals, the Astros, who are just, who also partially tarnished, but then won a World Series after they've been exposed. So, and then the Rangers and the Diamondbacks were in the World Series last year, and the Rangers won. And so when I see the way it's played out, Shohei Ohtani doesn't guarantee, especially with the way the Dodgers have operated over the last decade and a change, the way they haven't won a World Series outside of COVID, that it doesn't guarantee that they're going to win a World Series during his 10-year run. And
I just want to say, you know, the Braves are like the picture perfect organization as far as, you know, like apart from what the Dodgers are doing by spending all the money. The Braves draft, they develop, they identify, and they keep. And for the last 2 years, the Braves have been the best team in baseball for the majority of the last two seasons, and they have not won a World Series. And the thing that I always tell people, you know, they won the World Series a few years ago. The Braves won as many World Series with Adam Duvall, Jacques Peterson, and Jorge Soler as they did with Tom Glavine, Greg Maddux, and John Smoltz, three of the greatest pitchers to ever live. You don't have to be the best team. You don't have to win the offseason.
That's a perfect point, too. And to touch upon, before we move on to David Stern, about the ballpark, I went to both Citi Field last year and Yankee Stadium last year. Great Yankee Stadium game, Tampa Bay Yankees on Anthony Rizzo bobblehead night, Mandalorian bobblehead night, where he was the hero. It was a pretty spectacular game to like the one Yankee game I had been to in what felt like a decade. But here's what I noticed. Citi Field has been completely Steve Cohen came in there and said, make sure everything is state-of-the-art. You have automatic sinks. You have – I don't know if the water fountains are automatic, but they're definitely, like, shiny and new. And everybody raves about the food. And as much as you still kind of have that feeling that this was created by the Wilpons, it is as far a cry from 2009 when we had every single thing to criticize, especially because the team is the most disappointing Mets team of my lifetime. We had everything to criticize, and rightly so, about that stadium. When I went to Yankee Stadium, I couldn't believe that the sinks felt like they were in 2009. The water fountain felt like it was in 2009. Everything that I had been saying about the narrative right now of the New York Yankees, and the way I like to say it,
is that both the front office or just the organization itself and the fan base are in a bit of an existential crisis, because I personally don't think they're ever going to dominate the way that they dominated in the 20th century again. And I think that they are trying to come to grips with how they need to go about this new era, both, again, the fan base as well as the organization itself. And you see that Hal Steinbrenner, who is clearly reacting I think he's triggered by the fact that his dad was as bombastic and spend happy as he was, and seeing that in many ways George Steinbrenner was glorified. He had the personality, but a lot of times, every time he got too free agent happy, they didn't win World Series. In fact, they ended up falling flat on their faces. There's really only one championship in our modern lifetime outside of the 77 and 78 when basically he was able to immediately take advantage of free agency and win a couple World Series. Outside of that, 2009 is really the only time that it's worked, where you brought in all these players that hadn't been in the organization the year before and won a World Series a year after the last Yankee Stadium year, the last original Yankee Stadium year, and you don't make the playoffs for the first time in a long time. 2009 is the only time it's worked. And so I saw that Hal Steinbrenner has kind of gone a little too far to the opposite end of his father, because it doesn't look like they've improved anything about that stadium, from the littlest of details like the bathroom sinks and the water fountain, man. Whereas you go to Citi Field, everything's been updated since Steve Cohen come here. Like, it just and even in the presentation of the let alone just the new screen, but the way that the media of the stadium is being displayed, it's night and day from what the Wilpons were doing. So I just think that it's so obvious that we just need to let it play out, like you said. I couldn't agree more about that.
Yeah, when you look at what Cohen's done so far with regards to the stadium and the non-on-the-field product, with regards to acknowledging the history of the Mets, you know, retiring numbers and then, you know, adding more for Doc and Darryl this year, and, you know, things that seemed long overdue. If the Wilpons were doing this, there would be the joke of, oh, the Mets are giving you, you know, big TV, like, you know, high-def TV screens instead of getting you Shohei Ohtani. But with Cohen, and this is the one way he's safe, is that he's already gone out and gotten you the players. Now, it hasn't always worked, but I don't think anybody could argue with the thought process from a baseball standpoint. He went out and got Lindor and signed him to a mega deal. He went out and got Scherzer and Verlander. He signed Edwin Diaz. They gave Jacob deGrom an offer that was very fair considering everything. Jacob deGrom chose to leave. They didn't let him walk. And so when you look at what he's done on the field, you can't, not if you're a rational person, say, oh, he's giving you new water fountains and to distract from the fact that the team on the field's not good. No, he's giving you new water fountains because the guy is a businessman and the guy understands that it's a fan experience and you're in the service industry apart from being in the sports industry. And if your service is no good, people aren't going to enjoy being there. That's why he's giving you all that other stuff. You know, I've been to Patriot Place in Foxborough, and for different reasons, because Foxborough is kind of in the middle of nowhere, but Foxborough, like that area that they've built up is incredible. There's a hotel, there's restaurants, there's bars, there's nightlife, there's a mall. Now, you know, Flushing, Queens is not in the middle of nowhere, but the way that that area has been neglected around Citi Field for decades, apart from the tennis stadium, the way that area has been neglected, it might as well be in the middle of nowhere. So for Steve Cohen to look at that from a fan experience standpoint, and let's call it what it is, it's not totally altruistic, right? He's going to make a ton of money if this is what he builds. And if this is the legacy that he leaves there, it's going to be good for him and for his family and all of that stuff. But the byproduct for us is that we get a better experience win, lose, or draw. And that is not something that I think should be made fun of, certainly. I don't even think it's something that should be made light of. To me, that matters. The experience of going to these games matters. I'm a diehard Jets fan. I don't live in New York anymore. I'm on the West Coast, so I don't get the opportunity to go to Mets or Jets games as much as I would like. But I miss going to Mets games at Citi Field. I don't miss going to MetLife Stadium at all. What's the difference? MetLife Stadium doesn't have a great experience. It's not pretty. The food's not great. There's not great sight lines everywhere. There's also nothing around it. It takes forever to get there if you're going from, you know, the boroughs. So, you know, there's a lot of things that negatively affect the experience that you're getting as a fan when you go there. And, oh, by the way, the Jets have been horrendous for 12 years. Maybe I go to more of those games just to go get some good food, especially if the tickets for the Jets games are $12. But because they've made it so inaccessible and so unenjoyable, well, I'll just watch the game on my couch for free, and then if the game gets out of hand, I can turn it off and I can go enjoy my Sunday. I haven't committed 6 hours to trekking to the Meadowlands. So to me, the change that Steve Cohen is making, and I don't want to spend more time on this, but I think that stuff should not be understated. I don't think it should be underappreciated. And like I said earlier, I certainly don't think it's reason for talking heads on television or on WFAN or just even people on Twitter who, quite frankly, don't understand. I don't think it's something they should be making fun of.
Not to mention it's been raining every Sunday at the Meadowlands. Yeesh, geez, they can't catch a break.
Yeah.
At least they were able to power through with this past one. But this is not a Jets podcast, even though we might touch upon them a little more later as well. You are listening to the Metsian Podcast. We are here with Mets fan and entertainer John Saponaro. And, John, before we get into David Stearns, I want to give you an opportunity to give, you know, usually at the halfway mark, and we're 7 minutes in, that we like to let the guest give a shameless plug as well as his Metsian roots. So if anybody out there has not heard John's story, by all means, John, let us know. How did you become a Mets fan, and where can everybody find you?
First of all, let's go with where people can find me because that's easy. I'm pretty accessible on social media. I'm on Twitter or X. I'm on Instagram, and I'm on TikTok. All of them, it's just my name. It's at John Saponaro, J-O-H-N-S-A-P-O-N-A-R-O. Really easy to find that way. I do a ton of stuff in entertainment, like you mentioned. You know, some of it is things I can talk about, some of it's things I can't talk about. But, you know, you've seen me in some places, perhaps you've heard me in some other places. My comedy's been on SiriusXM and things like that. Currently, I do host two podcasts. I have a Mets podcast and a Jets podcast. They both also have a live stream component. So the Mets podcast is called Till Mets Do Us Part. And the Jets podcast is called The Goddamn Jets from the Adam Sandler movie, Big Daddy. So it's just the most appropriate way. Yeah, it's the most appropriate way to describe the Jets. So so those are the two shows. You know, the Jets show goes live every Tuesday at 4:30 Eastern PM on YouTube. And the YouTube channel is called The Goddamn Jets. The Mets show is live every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m., both times Eastern. And again, that YouTube channel is called Till Mets Do Us Part. So been doing the Mets show a little bit longer. We've had some great guests on in the past. We're looking to have some more guests in the offseason this year. We've had Turk Wendell and Glendon Rush, Ed Lynch, Ty Kelly, Todd Frazier, among some other folks, too, who are escaping me at the moment. So it's a great show. It's a ton of fun. I've got a great co-host, and I've got great co-hosts over on the Jets side as well. And so if anybody is a Mets and Jets fan, you want to listen to those shows, that's where you can find it. And if you don't want to watch them live, you don't have to, because there's also a podcast component. The entire show drops as an audio podcast the following day This is usually the next morning, wherever anybody gets their podcast. So Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, all those places. You can just listen to the show instead. As far as my Mets roots, I kind of follow what you were saying earlier, you know, about the teams leaving. So my grandfather grew up, like, in the shadow of Ebbets Field. And so he was a diehard Brooklyn Dodger fan his entire life growing up. And he always said to me, I learned everything about baseball from him, and he always said to me that he grew up at a time when there were three teams in New York, and you loved one and you hated the other two. And so when the Dodgers left, and, you know, obviously the Giants leave too, but when the Dodgers left, he was like, well, I couldn't bring myself to ever root for the Yankees. And he tried to follow the Dodgers for the first couple of years before the Mets became a thing. But, you know, when back in the late 50s, early 60s, it's kind of impossible to, you know, follow a team on the other side of the country and playing three time zones away. I think we take that for granted now. I could say I certainly do as somebody who lives on the West Coast now and watches Met games every night. But, you know, so like many others, when the Mets became a thing in 62, it was like, well, I'm a National League fan. I was a Dodgers fan. And, you know, I hate the Yankees. So I'm going to go ahead and root for this new team called the Mets. And so everybody in my family is pretty much a Mets fan. And, you know, baseball is the only two sports I care about are baseball and football from a rooting perspective. But baseball is definitely my first love. Maybe it's because I grew up playing baseball. I still play softball multiple times a week. So it's, you know, just something that's near and dear to me. And, yeah, I mean, me and my grandfather were very close as well. And so, you know, there's just kind of this connection there. So Mets fan through and through and through.
That's fantastic, and to segue with my shameless plug that actually has a lot to do with what you just said, I want to make an HBO-style TV series about Brooklyn and the Dodgers, and I've had that idea for a very long time, kind of born out of quote-unquote retro Dodger Park from, I believe, MVP 04, all of a sudden realizing this should be I think at the time, movie, and obviously I've since developed it into a TV idea, and I do a podcast called Bedford and Sullivan as well that basically supports that idea, kind of, as I always say at the beginning of that show, keeps the audience active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. So you are more than welcome to come on and talk some Brooklyn and talk about your grandfather at next time that we do a podcast. So the invitation's out there for a Bedford and Sullivan, John Saponaro appearance. So thank you. And
I would absolutely love to do that.
and also, it's like you're talking about how you rooted for, you loved one team and hated the other. Like, my story also involves being a converted Mets fan from Yankees. And so I've been on both sides of this city's current rivalry, and even though they don't play each other, you know, except for six times a year, it's still because of the fan base's vicinity to each other, it is a rivalry. And at some point, I hope this doesn't happen, but it may happen, there may be some realignment, and they do become divisional opponents, and it's going to be weird to say that, but it's probably the direction everything's heading, the way Rob Manfred is butchering this sport. But let's not all of a sudden we get canceled.
No, I know. You know, it's funny, and we don't have to get in the weeds on this, but I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the things Manfred has done, and more specifically, I don't love the way he carries himself with regards to those decisions. I am for creativity. I don't think that just because something has been away for 20 years or 30 years or 50 years or 100 years, that it means you can never change it. But
right,
there's something interesting to me about realignment that I think makes a lot of sense. But I think what they would need to do is, you know, when the NFL did their realignment, they were careful to not break up classic rivalries, i.e. there's no reason for the Dallas Cowboys to still be in the division with the Giants and the Eagles and the Commanders, but yet there they are because it's such a longstanding rivalry. So, you know, there's a part of me that thinks it would be fun and interesting to have a division
I mean, it would be an absolute bloodbath most years, so that part wouldn't be fun. But it would be fun and interesting to have a division that consists of, you know, the Mets, the Yankees, the Phillies, and the Red Sox, and really lean into, and maybe there'd have to be more depending on how they're doing it or whatever, but just those four teams, when you look at the rivalry between those three cities and then the intra-city rivalry between the Mets and the Yankees, that's so interesting. But then you do lose, you know, you'd probably lose Mets Braves. Like, that would be the thing, right? Like, you'd lose that
right.
part of the rivalry. Whereas, you know, the Yankees wouldn't necessarily lose their main rival because geographically it would make the most sense for them to remain. I guess if you were going to add another team in there, it would probably be the Washington Nationals, just, again, geographically. But so I'm not completely opposed to it because I think there's some parts of that that make sense, but there's a lot of it that doesn't make sense.
Right.
That would be kind of hard to swallow. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, John, for you know, your shameless plug and your Metsian roots. And without further ado, let's move on to David Stern. So the site SNY TV, they had an Instagram post that had all of the Mets offseason moves, which, like they say, the Mets have made several supplemental moves for their roster this offseason as they look to fill out the 40-man and provide depth in the minor league. So let's go through it real quick. We have Luis Severino from the Yankees, 1 year, $13 million. Of course, a starting pitching option. Joey Wendell.
I love that deal, by the way. Absolutely love the Severino deal. The Severino deal is a slam dunk.
Yeah, it's just the injury history is a little concerning for me, but, you know, when is it not with the Mets anyway? It's just, like, even when there is no injury history, we have to deal with it. Right. Exactly. Hopefully we have a 1-2 tandem that is of Eastern roots coming up, but not to jinx it, knock on wood. a utility piece, I believe, Joey Wendell, 1 year, $2 million. We have a bullpen piece, Austin Adams, 1 year deal. Cooper Hummel, claimed off waivers, who I do believe is also a bench piece. Kyle Crick, a minor league deal, who could be another bullpen piece from the Rays. Michael Tonkin, 1 year, $1 million, and I forget whether I saw what – I don't remember what his numbers were, but I just love the idea of picking up somebody who – like, how often do you see somebody who was in a Braves uniform that's not Tom Glavine now on the Mets? And we see it the opposite all the time with the Braves. In fact, you know, the whole Jared Kelenic thing happened, which triggered – like, I'm pretty sure the Braves do it just to trigger Mets fans and the Mets. We have Jorge Lopez on a one-year, $2 million, looking to have a bounce-back year after a successful 2022. Jose Iglesias on a minor league deal for some shortstop shortstop depth. And as you mentioned earlier, Trace Thompson, minor league deal. So with that as just the foundational conversation piece of the moves he's made, let's talk about the, you know, this is the first time you're on the podcast since David Stern came to the Mets. So let's talk both macro and micro when it comes to David Stern.
You know, again, from a macro perspective, I don't want to repeat some of the stuff I said at the beginning when I was tying it into Cohen, but this is what Stern does. And so for all the Mets fans who were clamoring for David Stearns for the better part of 3 years, and I was one of them. I thought he was the perfect fit. I think you have to take a step back for some of them, those same people that maybe were clamoring for him that are now frustrated. You need to understand that this is who he is and this is what he does. And he was very successful doing this in a team that, you know, is a smaller market, doesn't have the richest owner in the sport, and therefore doesn't spend the most money. And so these little moves are winning moves. You need to have actual legitimate depth. I made a comment on my podcast the other day that everybody looks back at the bench mob from a couple of years ago, and they remember so fondly what that was like. If you go and you look at the individual members of that quote-unquote bench mob, none of them are really good baseball players.
And none of them really have ever been good baseball players. Luis Guillorme, Tomas Nito. You know, Jonathan Villar has had, you know, a pretty nice career, so I would say that's an unfair thing to say to him. You know, Kevin Pillar, maybe a couple moments here and there. But by and large, those players, and other players were certainly a part of it, were not good. But yet Mets fans look back on it fondly because everybody loves to attach themselves to a, you know, a scrappy player or, a, you know, an interesting moment in time. But they're not quality depth. Maybe VR and Pillar, you could say both of those guys, quality depth players. That's what the Mets are trying to do here with a guy like Joey Wendell. Now, Wendell's not going to – he's not going to excite anybody, and he shouldn't, quite frankly. But they basically go out and get Wendell in exchange for Luis Guillorme. They decide to not tender Luis Guillorme and bring in a guy like Joey Wendell. When I look at that, I think a couple things. One, Joey Wendell was an all-star at one point. Now, I don't think he's ever going to be that good again, but that's something he's done that Luis Guillorme can never set. He also has more power than Luis Guillorme. Luis Guillorme is basically a poor man's, a very, very poor man's Jeff McNeil. You know, he's a spray hitter. He makes too much contact because he doesn't walk enough, and so that's another issue. So, you know, somebody with a little bit more pop, that's nice. That's exciting. You also have a player who, in Wendell, is as good, if not, you know, let's just say for all intents and purposes, he's as good defensively as Luis Guillorme. He can play all the spots on the infield. He can also play left field and right field, and he's considered a plus defender in all the places. So you're getting two more potential places that he can play than Guillorme played, at really three, because if you could, if you had to, you could put Wendell at first in a pinch. And so, you know, Guillorme's never going to play first, and he's not going to play left or right field either. So you're getting a more versatile player for basically the same amount of money that you would have had to pay Luis Guillorme had you tendered him. Now, Luis Guillorme also has taken a step back defensively over the last two seasons. And the non-baseball side of it is sometimes you just need to make a change for the sake of change. You have to give other players the opportunity who didn't work out in a place to come here, and you have to give a player who's on your roster who hasn't worked out the chance to go work out somewhere else. So, and I'm not even going to mention the stuff with his dad and the things Guillorme's dad said on Twitter and whether or not that factors in, because to me, it's irrelevant. I don't think he's that good of a baseball player, and so let's replace him with somebody who has a comparable skill set, who is going to give you just the same amount of mediocrity but has higher upside potential. And again, that's the identifying, the finding diamonds in a rough that Stearns is known for. I'll take a lot of the relief pitchers that you mentioned kind of just all in one basket, because some of them are on major league deals, some of them are on minor league deals, some of them are on split deals. But Stearns has excelled in building bullpens. And the Mets, by and large, for as long as I can remember, have not excelled in building bullpens. So I'm going to trust David Stearns more than I trust anybody on Mets Twitter, more than I trust you, with all due respect, more than I trust myself. Because he has a reputation of doing it, and none of us have ever built a bullpen. And some of the guys that he's bringing in, the Kyle Cricks of the world, have some peripheral things that look really exciting, you know, high spin rates, you know, whiff rates, things like that. You know, their analytics, and I know some people don't like to hear that stuff. They're just like, his ERA was bad, and that means he's bad. But when you're a team that has now built a pitching lab and you'd like to test the mettle of that pitching lab, this is how you do it. Go get a guy who was good in Kyle Crick with the Rays a couple of years ago before he got hurt, and see if you can do what the Rays do. Every year, every single year, the Rays have people in their bullpen that you could not recognize if you hit them with your car. And yet they continue to be one of the best bullpens in baseball every single year. They bring these guys up. They have good stuff. Maybe they get hurt. Maybe they trade them 2 years later. Some guys fizzle out, but then they just replace them again. They're like a bunch of creative players from MLB The Show.
and they just pop up and they're good every year. And that's what I want the Mets to be able to do, because spending a ton of money in the bullpen is not a good way to build a baseball team, because bullpens are fickle. Year to year, there's ups, there's downs. There's only ever been one Mariano Rivera, and but beyond him, there's very few pitchers, bullpen pitchers, who have been widely successful. The Billy Wagners, you know, you look at somebody like Edwin Diaz, who has had, you know, 1 year with us and 1 year in Seattle, where they're all-time years for closers, right? So he's had two unbelievable years. Even guys like Eric Gagne, who were terrific for a while, fizzled out. You know, Craig Kimbrell's probably going to go to the Hall of Fame. He's not the same pitcher he was when he first came up with Atlanta. You know, these guys, sometimes they get by on reputation or name or whatever. So I think you have to be willing to be creative and make moves differently and, you know, spend, you know, small amounts of money and take a chance on a player. So I'm fine with all of those things. And the last thing I'll say about the bullpen, I don't know if you feel this way, but the last just, let's say, 4 years, let's just say since Steve Cohen has owned the team, the most infuriating thing about the Mets bullpen is there seems to be one guy who has stuff, and that's Edwin Diaz. Now, Bryce Montes de Oca has stuff, but he blew out his elbow and he missed all of last year. Everybody else is a lot of guys who maybe a couple of them, like Drew Smith, throw hard, but their secondary pitches leave a lot to be desired, or they throw really hard and it's straight. Or you're somebody like Adam Ottavino, who if his slider is on, it's deadly. If his slider is off, it's a helicopter and it's batting practice. I would like some guys in the bullpen besides Edwin Diaz who have stuff, who can get by. They come out and they're like, here's 103. Try to hit it. That's it. Just try to hit it. I'm going to throw it as hard as I can at you, or I'm going to throw 98 with a little bit of cut, and you're not going to touch it. The Mets don't have a lot of those guys. So if you're telling me that some of these players that they signed in the bullpen are spin rate guys, like really nasty slider guys, high fastball velocity guys, I take my chance on those guys every day, especially if you're trying to build a pitching lab. Let's see if it works. Let's see if your pitching lab is worth the money that you paid for it. The last person I'll say is Severino. I said it before. I think it's a great deal. The reason why is there's no such thing as a bad one-year deal, like I said earlier. And with Severino, you have so much room to play. If Severino is even any semblance of what he was early in his career with the Yankees, now all of a sudden you're getting an ace-level pitcher at a bargain. And if you're good and competitive, well, that's terrific. If you're bad, well, that's terrific because you can trade him at the deadline. If he's bad, it's not a lot of money relative to what pitchers make. And if he's somewhere in the middle, as long as he's healthy, he's going to eat innings because he's always eaten innings when he's been healthy. And I know the 6.65 ERA looks ugly, ugly. But his stuff, to go back to the last conversation, is still among the best in baseball for starters. The guy's fastball is electric. The guy's movement is electric. And I talked to somebody who's a former player who knows more about baseball than you or me, knows more about pitching, and he said there is no way that Severino could have gotten touched up to the tune of an ERA almost 7 with that kind of stuff without tipping his pitches. And if he was tipping his pitches, that's just one person's opinion, but if he was tipping his pitches, that can be fixed. And if that can be fixed, and he doesn't have to go back to being the Severino that had a 2.2 ERA, but if he's Severino that has a 3.50 ERA, he's going to win a lot of games for the Mets. He's going to pitch a lot of innings for the Mets, and the Mets are going to be in a lot of games. So to me, that move made absolutely all the sense in the world. So I like what he's done so far. And like I said back when I was talking about Cohen at the beginning, when you look at what Stearns did, he wiped the roster clean. Like, he opened the airlock on the spaceship and jettisoned all the things he could get rid of that he didn't want to deal with. And he kept the players around that he either had to or that are useful, that he thinks are useful. And so, again, I'm going to trust his decision-making in this before, you know, my own, because, again, he's an executive in baseball and I'm not, but also not even in that most realistic sense, he's the guy I wanted, and he's been here for 2 months, so I'm going to let him do his thing because I wanted him. I said it back when Steve Cohen first got the job that he was the guy I wanted. The only other person I thought that was close or comparable would have been if you could ever talk Theo Epstein into coming back, I would have taken Theo Epstein in a heartbeat. Outside of that, it was Epstein and Stearns. That's it. So I accepted the other guys they brought in. You know, I thought the other guys – I didn't think Epler did a great job, but I didn't think he did a terrible job. But, you know, this is the guy that I wanted. Forget about everybody else. The guy I wanted. So I'm going to trust him to do what I think – what he thinks is right.
You are listening to the Betsian podcast, and before we talk about the 680-pound gorilla in the room, 680-million-pound gorilla in the room, excuse me, I just want to touch on and say condolences to the McKenzie family. Ken McKenzie, who was the original 1962 Met, has passed, and I'm going to quote Howie here, "Sad to hear of the passing of original Mets pitcher Ken McKenzie. Imagine having a winning record for the 1962 Mets. He went 5-4. Team won only 40 games. He went to Yale, and upon entering a game from the bullpen, Casey Stengel told him, 'Make like they're the Hogwarts.' Rest in peace, Ken McKenzie." And I know our friend Faith and Fear in Flushing's Greg Prince would have a ton to say on him, I'm sure. He is the encyclopedia of Mets knowledge. And so I look forward to reading up on Ken McKenzie over there on Faith and Fear and Flushing, because I'm sure Greg has either written one or is on the way to writing one. So just wanted to mention that before we moved on. And I think it's only natural, because it's the talk of baseball, that we talk about the Shohei Ohtani deal with those highway bums out there in your town, your current town, John. Those Dodgers, and I think, you know, I think there's a lot of people that have had a lot of opinions. I haven't seen yet one that says this is good. I think a lot of people think it's like, you know, spits in the face of competitive balance. If Steve Cohen or Steinbrenner had done this, people would have flipped the lid. And of course, Manfred's not going to do anything about it. He's already been introduced. So what is your opinion of the Shohei Ohtani deal? And I also, considering it sounds like he was never going to consider cold weather anyway, I don't understand all these reports being like, oh, the Mets decided to pull out when they knew it was going to be too high. It's like, it sounds like the Mets pulled out when he wasn't even going to consider an open-air stadium in a cold area anyway. So I think some of this reporting is nonsense, and I don't want to you know, point any fingers at anybody, but, your opinion about this as far as I'm concerned, monstrosity of deferred contracts.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on it. First thing I'll say, I'm a New Yorker through and through, from Brooklyn, lived there for the first 33 years of my life, and now I live in Southern California in Los Angeles. I love New York. I'm grateful that I'm from New York. New York will always be home. Having lived here for the past 4.5 years, I can say with certainty that I understand why people prefer it. The weather makes a huge difference. It's the cliche, oh, go there for the weather. Go there because you can go to the mountains and go skiing and go to the beach all on the same day. It helps. It does. It's a great place to live for that reason. You know, I told you I still play baseball and softball now. And, you know, I had a championship softball game last night. It's, you know, the middle of December, and it was, you know, not warm out, but it was, it was about 48, 50 degrees. Certainly can play all year round. And, you know, so there are some advantages to living out here. So, you know, I don't really begrudge anybody for coming out here or staying out here. The other thing I will say is that a lot of people say that, like, Dodger fans are frauds. And I've been to a lot of Dodger games, certainly when they play the Mets. Like this past season, I went to all three games versus the Mets. But the fans out here are real. You do get the celebrity fan. You do get the fact that fans arrive late. But there is such a contingent of real Dodger fans, real baseball fans. It's a great ballpark to play in. It's a great city to play for. And so I don't begrudge anybody who wants to play here. That said, from a Mets perspective, I think you're spot on. I think the Mets were told early on, don't even ask. I think that's kind of what Cohen was alluding to when he said the agent didn't reach out to me, and that's pretty telling. It is telling because that's who Cohen is. He's got more money than everybody. And if even just to raise the price for the destination he really wanted to go to, you would think they would get the rich guy involved. I think as soon as Shohei was not going to pitch this year, it changed the prospect for the Mets from a Mets perspective. I think they looked at him and said, I don't know, man. I don't know if $500 million plus is going to be the amount of money we want to spend on somebody who is having his second Tommy John surgery. Because first Tommy John surgery, you come back as good, if not better. Second Tommy John surgery, the results are a lot less, they're a lot more suspect. So I think that that's a factor. I think Shohei's going to be fine. I think the Dodger fans are going to love him. I think he'll be great out here. But from a Mets perspective, even if he was interested, I could see how that changes. The other thing I'll liken it to is the Aaron Judge situation from last year. On my show, I was like, there's the biggest free agent in the game right now is Aaron Judge. The Yankees might lowball him. He loves New York. He doesn't want to leave New York. The Mets need an outfielder. Sign Aaron Judge. At least try. And it was basically reported after the fact that, you know, the Mets reached out and it was like, look, if I go anywhere else, it's not going to be like, I'm not going to do that to the Yankees. I'm not going to go to the Mets. And it was like, okay, well then we're not even going to think about it. We're going to move on. You know, it takes two to tango. It takes two to make a deal. And, you know, Ohtani never really seemed like a fit. It would have been great. But, you know, for all of those reasons, I don't think he was ever going to be on the Mets. As far as the contract goes, there's a lot of it that makes a ton of sense. For Shohei Ohtani, it does make sense that he's putting winning first. He makes $50 million a year in endorsements. So he can afford to take $2 million of salary and not have his deferred money accrue interest. That's one of the biggest differences between his deferrals and some of the other deferrals in the history of Major League Baseball. A lot of those deferrals come with interest. So he's actually taking, quote-unquote, less money because obviously with inflation, money only gets less valuable. And so he's getting paid 10 years from now in today's money. Now, it's still an astronomical amount of money. I understand that. But from that perspective, it makes sense for him because he's putting the winning over getting as much money as he possibly can. The other thing is there's obviously the tax benefits. The way the tax law is written is that he can collect the money because it's deferred in the state that he is living in when the payments start and not the state that the contract was signed in. So if he decides to retire to Florida, he'll make up some of that money that he's not getting in interest and the fact that he won't have to pay state income tax. And he's doing all of that so that the Dodgers could be under the threshold or closer to under the threshold so that they continue to add talent like they just did a couple minutes before we went live. They traded for Manuel Margot and Tyler Glasnow. And the trade with Glasnow is contingent, according to the reports, is contingent upon the Dodgers signing him to an extension. So, you know, the Dodgers are going for it. They're adding another big deal, it seems, because Glasnow is going to want a lot of money. I mean, he's hurt a lot, but he's a very talented pitcher. I think there's a little bit of a trickle down there because if they sign him to a big deal, maybe they don't go as hard for Yamamoto, or at the very least, they're not putting all their eggs in the Yamamoto basket, which I think is smart from their perspective. I think they want him, but I don't know if they're looking at it and saying, if you look at the Dodgers, their lineup looks terrific. Their pitching staff is terrible. So they need Glasnow and more. So they always needed to go out and get another pitcher, even if they got Yamamoto. But so it makes sense from a couple different perspectives for the team and for Ohtani. The two things that I find the most curious are the fact that, not the deferrals, the fact that Ohtani can opt out of his contract at any moment if the controlling owner of the Dodgers is let go, or if Andrew Friedman, the president of baseball ops, is let go. And to me, that one is wild. Maybe not the owner as much, because, you know, the Dodgers are owned by a group, and so the figurehead owner could play a role in how the team operates. If he's replaced by, you know, a different board member or something, and they don't spend as much and they don't have the same commitment to winning, I could see how that might get into the contract. Tying your star to a president of baseball operations for a 10-year period is something I never thought I would ever see a team do. Now, granted, Friedman is a great executive. He's had success there. The Dodgers tried like hell to get him before they got him. So a lot of that makes, you know, it doesn't seem like they're going to want to get rid of him anytime soon. But things happen. 10 years is a lot for a GM, president of baseball ops. You know, the message can get sour. So you're basically saying we've got to have both of these guys together for the next 10 years, which I thought was very curious. I mean, it certainly gives Andrew Friedman a lot of job security to kind of do whatever he wants. But the last thing I'll say about the deal is I agree with you. As a Mets fan, I'm a little frustrated because I think if Cohen did it, I don't think baseball would have looked to block it the way you're saying, because I don't think they would have been able to, because it's technically not disallowed in the rules. But I think maybe next year or next time the CBA comes around, it would be blocked if Cohen did it. I think they'd find a way to block it after the fact so that he couldn't continue to do it. You know, Major League Baseball didn't block him from making any of the trades at the deadline where he ate a bunch of money to basically buy a farm system. So I don't know if it would have been, you know, seen as would have been as frowned upon by the league as some people think. Although I do think the league definitely has it out for Steve Cohen. So it's a little bit of both. The other thing I'll say is I think there's a portion, I think the small market teams are partially to blame for this, which I know sounds crazy because they're not the ones who are signing this deal and they couldn't even dream of signing this deal. But the commissioner has made it more and more punitive every year, pretty much, every opportunity he gets, for big market teams that have a lot of resources and have rich owners to use those resources to build a winning baseball team. He's made it harder. He's made it more punitive in the form of luxury tax, the Cohen tax, all the stuff that you want to talk about. He also hasn't done anything to address the fact that these smaller market teams don't spend any money. I mean, you have teams that have a $30 million payroll at a time when every team should have a payroll of a minimum of $100 million because every team gets $100 million of the shared TV revenue that goes to Major League Baseball. So that money that they're getting from the league should have to go directly into player payroll. That would raise the competitive balance immediately. That doesn't even have anything to do with them selling tickets, with them selling merch, with them selling jerseys, with them anything. And it has nothing to do with the smallest market teams getting that luxury tax windfall from the bigger market teams. They're getting $100 million before they even open the doors on April 1st or March 29th or whatever opening day is going to be. So I think the fact that the commissioner is in bed with the worst owners of the league rather than being in bed with the best owners of the league makes stuff like this something that you have to do. I'm not sure that the Dodgers would have deferred all of that money if the luxury tax thresholds weren't so punitive towards building a winning team. And, you know, you could say whether or not it's good for baseball, and we could debate that, but at the end of the day, what I think is worse for baseball is that every year there's only about 10 teams that try to win. And it's the same 10 teams by and large every year, right? It's the Dodgers, the Yankees. Now since Cohen has owned them, it's the Mets. The Red Sox took a step back to reset their luxury tax, but they're right there.
you have teams that spend a lot of money that maybe don't spend it the best, but they spend it like Anaheim and, you know, San Diego recently. The Cubs spend a good amount of money. And that's it. Really, the other teams that spend money when they're close. You know, if the Giants think they can win a World Series, they'll spend more money. If this team thinks they can win a World Series, they'll spend more money. And other than that, you have basically two-thirds of the league that doesn't even try to win. And you have the commissioner of the sport saying, we have to do something about that. Yeah, make them spend money. I don't want to hear anybody who owns a baseball team cry poverty. It is, one, absurd. Two, it is disrespectful to every regular person in this country and in the world who is not a billionaire. And it also is not something that gains sympathy from me for the simple fact that if you're worth $2 billion, there are so many things you can invest in to make money that give you an ROI that have no responsibility on your end to put a winner out there. When you join a sports league, you're basically signing a social contract that you're going to be competitive or at least try. Now, small markets do exist, but poor owners do not exist. There is no such thing as a poor owner in Major League Baseball. John Fisher, who owns the A's, is worth over $2 billion. He is in the top half of rich owners in the sport. And he has done everything to humiliate that team, strip that team down to nothing, destroy the fan base, all so that he could move that team to Vegas. He should be investigated for what he did. So I think that these teams and these owners are more to blame for what the Dodgers felt like they had to do for Shohei Ohtani than anything else. And at the very least, I don't like it because it's a frustrating thing. Dodgers are getting really good, and the Mets have to try to, you know, play catch-up with them now. But I'm never going to critique a baseball team for doing everything they can to win in the form of, like, everything that's legal. You know, not stealing signs like the Astros, not, you know, doing steroids and stuff like that. But, like, you know, if it's within the parameters of the rules, you should do it. And more teams should do it because more teams should try to win. So it's a complicated issue, but I have a lot of frustrations with the way the league is run, the way smaller markets are run, and the way the league just allows them to be built that way rather than stepping in. And there's always, you know, Rob Manfred always has vitriol for the Yankees and the Dodgers and Steve Cohen, and he never has anything negative to say about John Fisher, who I think might be the biggest con artist in sports. So, especially now that Dan Snyder doesn't own the Commanders anymore.
I think that is a very astute point you just made, and I had forgotten about that because people had mentioned in terms of the fact that they're not spending money a little, you know, like over a year ago or something, it came up a lot. So I think I'm appreciative of you for having mentioned it. And speaking of the Giants have officially agreed to a 6-year deal with outfielder Hung Hoo Lee, who is another Japanese post. Actually, no, I think he was a Korean posting, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
Pardon moi. But, yeah, that happened about 14 minutes from Jessica Kleinschmidt, who I believe she's an A's beat reporter. Speaking of John Fisher, who, yeah, you're right, it's one of the biggest con jobs in the history of the sport. And so before we go, I did mention earlier that I wanted to bring up a point about WFAN, which I still listen to on and off for sure. But I thought that you made a very solid video that was very funny, but where the reality and surreality, you know, blur, I think it sounded almost like I was actually listening to the station. So if you could elaborate for anybody who didn't see it and also kind of explain the point you were trying to make about the first 24-hour sports radio network that who's still operating, but
to many people's opinion, not as strong as they used to.
Yeah, thank you for saying so. It's kind of something I did just on a whim, although it does obviously represent my feelings about that particular station. Now, I am 37 years old, so I am just about as old as the fan is. I grew up listening to the fan. I mentioned my grandfather earlier. I have very distinct memories of my grandfather sitting in the kitchen in this chair that he loved to sit in and just kind of listening to WFAN, listening to Mike and the Mad Dog, and I would come in and I'd listen along with him. And at times I was too young to really understand the nuance of sports, but I remember those moments. So I have a lot of fond memories of the fan. Now, as I got older, I started listening to it more on my own, obviously. Being a comic, there were a lot of times spent in the car, pre-satellite radio. I'd listen to a lot of the fan, you know, overnight, driving back. And I became a fan of the network legitimately myself. And there are still people on the network that I am a fan of. I am friends with. She's been on my podcast. She's a part of the QBC. Lori Rubinson, who hosts once a week on the fan on Sunday nights. She's absolutely terrific. I like Chris McMonagle. I think he does a good job on the overnights now. But by and large, the lineup that is currently constituted on WFAN, and I think it's more so than the lineup, I think it's been the directive that they've been given from the top down, it's be controversial. It's be clickbait. You know, you mentioned before that there was a host on there that said Cohen is now the Wilpon. You can't say that with a straight face and believe it. You can't tell me you believe that. You can't. There's no evidence to back that up. And it all started with, you know, kind of the Skip Baylesses of the world, the people who say things to get a rise out of people. And it started because our, you know, our culture is so, you know, up to the second. Our culture is clicks. Our culture is instant gratification. And I think, though, when you're in media, legitimate media, and you're in journalism, you have a responsibility to have integrity. Now, I don't have to deal with ratings on my podcast. My podcast does what it does, and if it makes a little bit of money, that's fine. I don't make my living off of it. I understand how the industry works, that they are beholden to ratings. But I think if you just do good work, the ratings will come, especially because they always have. And I know radio is not the medium that it was 10 years ago, certainly 20, 30 years ago, and more than that, but there's still a place for it. I have a podcast. I listen to podcasts. Sometimes I don't want to listen to a podcast. This is a great podcast, but sometimes I just want to flip on the radio or the streaming version of the radio and see what's going on in real time, see what they're talking about. And I think that they've lost their way as a station because everything needs to be, you know, so reactionary. Everything needs to be outlandish. You have two people, you know, hosts that will disagree with each other just for the sake of controversy. And I just, I can't wrap my head around how that's good for the medium. It's almost like they've acknowledged, okay, you know, sports radio might be going the way of the dodo bird. So rather than try to save it, we're just going to milk everything out of it until it's dead. And to me, that pays no respect to the people who came before you, to the people who built the institution. And I just find it to be, I think the reason why you said, you know, it was like my video was funny, but you also felt like you were listening to the radio in that minute and a half clip is because the station has become a parody of itself. And I've not always agreed with, I said I was a fan and listened to it for most of my life. I've not always agreed with the hosts on there, but that's a sports debate. I've certainly had favorite hosts and least favorite hosts, but that's just personality preference. You know, now I just find it to be fundamentally unlistenable. And sometimes despite that, I still listen to it. And I think you can tell, right? Like there's the adage of like, you can't do parody well unless you know what the real thing is. You know, like, you can't pretend to be stupid unless you're smart. Like, you can't act stupid unless you're really smart, because you have to understand how it works. You can't play, you can't act drunk unless you've been drunk and you know what it's like to do that. And so I think in this case, and I don't know if those are great examples, but in this case, it's clear that even despite everything I'm saying, from time to time, I still listen to the station, because I don't think I would have been able to get the tenor of what the station sounds like without having known what the station sounds like. And so, look, the video gained a lot of traction on social media, most prominently Twitter, because I think that's where the most of my sports personality lives. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. I am a comedian, you know, as I've mentioned and as you've mentioned. And so I'm going to do what I do. I'm going to be funny. I'm going to poke fun at things. Even on my shows, on my podcast, like when we're sitting there and we're talking real mess stuff, like you and I have been talking for the last hour and a half, like, I talk real Mets, but I'm still going to be funny. If there's something there that I want to say, if there's so, like, you know, there have been some people from the station who haven't been particularly happy with the things that I've said, and it's like, all right, well, do better then. Because, I got into it with Spike Eskin, who is the head of that radio station, the program director. And I was like, why don't you go take a look at my comments, the comments section under my video. Take a look at that. Let me know if this is if you're doing right by your fans, since what you think what you're doing is so good. Take a look at the comments, and let me know if that's not a representative cross section. So, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse on it. I appreciate you bringing it up. It was a fun video to do. It was a spur of the moment video. I have commented on their posts before. I have tweeted things about them before in reaction, you know, just characters and stuff. And one day I was just like, you know, instead of tweeting something, I'm just going to make this video. I'm just going to sit down. It took me like 30 minutes. It didn't even take me that long. I was like, I'm going to just riff and make a video and put it out. And I never thought it would get the traction that it did, but I'm grateful that it did, and it was fun. I've since made another one. I don't know if I'm going to keep making them. I think as long as it's fun and there's something to talk about, I'll probably make some more of them, but I don't think it'll be like a regular thing necessarily.
I hear that, man, and, you know, I sometimes will actually go all the way back to the beginning of the day and utilize the Odyssey, no matter what, you know, the Odyssey app, and no matter what time that I start listening to it. And I think that I want to give a shout-out to Al Hughes and Jerry Recco and their wake-up, warm-up show, excuse me, prior to Boomer and Geo, because I think it's the most adaptable an entertaining show on the station, and you know, in terms of adaptable, I think it's the most adaptable within the current entertainment market regarding the way people are listening to things, both in the car and at home. You know, they don't take phone calls. I think it's a complete missed opportunity. It's only the main shows that they're uploading onto the YouTube page. I know that they put that show out as a podcast, but I think it's so entertaining, especially just the way it's basically almost like Jerry's playing the straight man from a classic entertaining perspective. And you know, Al's the character that he's just like, this is the way you're living your life? Like, I remember just one back and forth, and I forget the details, but I was just so enamored with the way that, and it wasn't even necessarily about sports. It was just the way that Al lives his life and talking about it in real time. Jerry's just shocked and appalled by the way he goes about things. And it was just very funny to me. And I thought they should take more advantage of this, because it's extremely entertaining. And that's really, as insightful as things can be, that's what the radio is there for, to keep you entertained while you're either on your way to work or on your way to an audition, whatever it may be. I think they should prop that one up a little bit more. And obviously they recognize, considering it used to only be like 15 minutes long, they recognized that it had popularity, so they extended it to an entire hour, meaning those guys had to be at the station that much earlier. I think it's that, you know, that sometimes is some of my favorite content on that station. So I got to check out the other video for sure, and I appreciate you doing it. And with all the heat that they've been taking lately, it was nice to see some something of that nature for sure. So I appreciate it.
Well,
and you guys,
I appreciate that very much. No, it's a great point that you made about Alan Jerry, and I just want to say, like, I know he's not on the station anymore, and I know there's plenty of other reasons to not like Craig Carton, the legal stuff and all the stuff that he did. But put all that stuff aside for a moment. You know, people often say to me, hey, yeah, just like Craig Carton, or Craig Carton ruined the station. And I to them I often say, I think Carton was less of the problem than a lot of people think, because what Carton did was play a character. He didn't try. If he was saying something outlandish, you could almost see it on his face without seeing his face. You knew he was just saying something. You know, this is the radio, and you're watching it, and you're like, this guy is saying it with the biggest, you know, crap-eating grin on his face, because he knows he's going to get a rise out of people who take it too seriously. And to me, that's different, because he's almost, at that point, it's almost satire. It's not quite, but it almost is. And then when you look at some of these other guys, they do it like it's straight-laced. And, you know, I mentioned Skip Bayless. And, you know, you guys, anybody can have the debate. Who's better, LeBron or Jordan? You can have the debate. Everybody has their opinions. It's fine. But if I have to watch Skip Bayless one more time say, like, some version of LeBron's not even that good, I'm going to explode. And the guy just scored, like, was it 40,000 points? Like, what are you talking about? Aside from the fact that, like, and it's not a basketball show, but whatever, like, LeBron James came out of high school with all the hype in the world and lived up to it. Do you know how impossibly hard LeBron James's career is to achieve? It's the same thing with a Bryce Harper. When people say, oh, how good, Bryce Harper's not that good. Bryce Harper has essentially been famous since he was a high school kid. He was 16 years old on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and he has turned himself into an MVP and one of the best players in baseball. That's all I care about. He doesn't have to be Ted Williams. You just look at the fact that he made good on it. He was a 16-year-old kid. So, like, for these people to say these outlandish claims, it's like you can't actually believe that. If you want to tell me Jordan is better than LeBron, sure, but you can't sit there and tell me LeBron's not even that good. And that's what these people do. You know, I got into it with one of them one time, said that, you know, the pizza in New York City isn't good anymore. And I was like, that's just objectively inaccurate. And he's like, it's just quantity over quality. There's just so many places in New York, and da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, look, he said something about the pizza being better in Connecticut and New Jersey and all this stuff. And I'm not a pizza snob. I've had great pizza in many places in the country that are not anywhere near New York. But the whole point of it was, I was like, look, you know, New Jersey and Connecticut certainly have some great places, but, like, I can name 10 places in Brooklyn alone that are excellent. And his response to me after going back and forth was, yeah, oh, that's what he said, the pizza in Connecticut, New Jersey, and Long Island is better than the pizza in the city. And I was like, look, I can name 10 places off the top of my head right now in Brooklyn, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, yeah, well, Brooklyn is on Long Island. And I was like,
oh, boy.
While you're technically accurate geographically, are you going to – so you're going to say now, for the sake of argument, that Brooklyn pizza is not New York City pizza but Long Island pizza? Like, you can't believe that. You can't believe that. That doesn't make any sense. I grew up in Brooklyn my whole life. My life was much more similar to somebody in Queens and Manhattan and the Bronx and Staten Island even than anybody out on Long Island. Come on. You can't honestly believe that. So, like, when these people say it, it's like, you know, you don't believe the thing that you're saying, and they'll take one little thread, like, well, geographically, Brooklyn is on Long Island, and they'll just run with that till the ends of the earth. And it's just, to me, it's an unfathomable way to live. We all want to be successful. You know, you're want to make a documentary on the Brooklyn Dodgers. You should, and I hope it's the best thing in the world. And I would be out there supporting
it. A dramatized. Just want to should specify too. I want to make it with actors dramatized. Because every documentary
of course,
is made about the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Sure. No, I understand where you're coming from. But, like, so sure, like, you know, a docu-series or, you know, whatever. But, like, and I love that. I think that's brilliant. And, you should do it. I'd be the first person supporting it. As somebody who is in entertainment, like, I understand the plight of what these people need to do in order to succeed and to keep your job and to pursue your dreams. But, like, man, if I ever had that little integrity about what I was doing, I really hope that somebody would check me. And that's the thing. I feel like so many of them have no integrity at all. And I don't mind saying it because I've said it to their faces literally if I've seen them in person. So, you know,
Colin Cowherd says things that you're like, you can't possibly actually believe what you just said. And considering he then contradicts himself months later, it's just absurd.
Yeah.
I avoid him like the plague, man. And also about that Bryce Harper cover, I will say that it's pretty spectacular that that cover wasn't made by AI.
Yes. Actual human photographers doing human photography.
How about that? Yeah, man. No, I think you hit the nail on the head about it. It's just like, yeah, there is ways to be successful without compromising your integrity, and that is what I actually do like about Craig Carton too. Because I think you're absolutely right. Like he, especially when he was with Evan, he knew that he was going to get a rise out of Evan, and you know that's what made it. I keep going back to the old adage of the straight guy. And the character actor, everybody, you know, people who are not in entertainment might not understand when you say straight guy. We're not talking about sexual orientation. We're just talking about kind of the Abbott and Costellos of the world. Basically, Abbott was the straight man, and Costello was the character. And you know, the way Craig Carton would get a rise out of Evan and just have this big, you know what, eating grin on his face. It was very entertaining and you know, good for him too. It's like everybody wants, and this is like a perfect example of the way we live in an age when nobody, like everybody used to love a redemption story and now nobody allows for a redemption story. And so good on Craig for not only overcoming his struggles, but also like understanding his place to help other people with that struggle. He had a Saturday show, and I think he still does that Saturday show about gambling. I may be wrong,
but when he first read.
Exactly. So like people, it's just like apparently there's no room for redemption anymore, and there's other names that I could mention that I'm happier back, but I'm not going to mention it. For fear of myself getting canceled for just saying that I like certain people that had some issues and are now having somewhat of a renaissance within their careers. So good on him, but also thank you for you know, I think you just put, you know, nailed it when it comes to some of these personalities. And it's just like, again, like I said about Colin, you can't possibly believe the things that are coming out of your mouth. But without further ado, you have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and we're so thankful that you do. Want to always give a big shout out to Rich Spirago and Michael Collant, who are my partners in crime on this podcast. They haven't been able to come on for various reasons in a while, and just want to give a big shout out to them, and all my love goes out to those two fellows. So thank you. And thanks for thanks to John Saperano for coming on I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name at the beginning. It's how do you pronounce it again?
It's Saperano. You actually got it right at the beginning.
Saperano. Saperano. John Saperano. He is a VO artist. He is a comedian, an actor, and he was the Queens Baseball Convention host before. Thank you so much for coming on. This is the time of the show when we like to do our final word.
So before I give my final word, by all means, John, go ahead.
If I could just say to Mets fans, you got to be patient. You have to trust. And I know people don't like to hear this phrase because it makes them think of, I guess, like the Philadelphia 76ers and some of their antics. But you have to trust the process. This is the guy you wanted. Let the guy you wanted do the job that you wanted him for. He's proven to be good at it. He has a track record of success. And if nothing else, trust the guy who is even above him, who has done nothing in his life but win, and that is Steve Cohen. He will figure out a way. I have all the belief in the world that the combination of Steve Cohen, just who he is as a person in terms of his business life and all that stuff, and David Stern being a true and true baseball lifer, I have all the confidence in the world that the two of them are going to figure it out. And I hope it's this season. You know, like I said, you don't have to win the off season. You don't have to do anything crazy to be a successful team or even win a World Series. But I hope it's this season. But if it's not, they're closer now, believe it or not, than they ever have been. They built a legitimate farm system. It's getting better all the time. They have a good core. They have good young players to supplement that core, and they're going to continue to get players. Remember not that long ago we talked about Bryce Harper, but remember not that long ago Bryce Harper was a free agent. And I love Bryce Harper. I think he's a terrific baseball player. The Mets under Wilpon didn't even talk to him. Didn't even talk to him. The Mets now, they talk to everybody. Or they talk to everybody who's at least willing to have the conversation with them. And so, you know, there's no moral victories in that. You want to come away with the player. I understand that. But the Mets are in on everybody, and they're always going to be in on everybody as long as Steve Cohen is the owner. So just be grateful for where we came from to what we have now, and eventually, sometime sooner rather than later, these people, Cohen, Stearns, and company, they're going to deliver a championship. I know they are.
John Saponara, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, and I greatly appreciate it. And my final word echoes in many ways what you are saying about patience. Haste makes waste. I will also quote Mike LeColant, who said it plenty of times, the 7 P's. Prior proper planning produces I think it's prior proper planning produces piss poor performance, or not prior, whatever it is. I'm going to have to call him up and get it exactly. But it's basically like, if you don't properly prepare priorly, you will have a piss poor performance. And considering that I didn't prepare to have that saying on here, I had a piss poor performance with that. So exactly my point. And it's something that we don't always in our own personal lives adhere to as well. And we don't reap the benefits because of it. I can certainly attest to identifying in many ways with the way the Mets narrative has gone, with the way that their entire history of underachieving has gone. And so we can't just win a World Series on December 14th. We need prior proper planning, and we need to change the narrative. And so take it easy, everybody. Keep calm, carry on, and let's go Mets. John Saponara, thank you as well again for joining us. And everybody out there, thank you for listening. Take care.